This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
This is a Q&A in the social sciences track with Bob Priest of Trinity and Sally Canning of Wheaton.
You know, I'll just look for hands, and I'm going to repeat your question because I have a loud voice. And we want to make sure the mic catches it, and then they'll, you know, you can direct your answer, your question to one or both, either Dr. Priest or Dr. Canning. So, who would like to go first?
Okay, I have a question. So, do you guys have any insights about how to use faith as a coping resource to help human beings in daily life? Because I have a couple of friends who are non-believers and who always say that, yes, we know the importance of having a good relationship with our parents, spouses, or children, but that's it. We don't want to go further to the realm of faith or religion, that kind of thing. I'm too busy for that. So do you have any insights about how to use faith to help them out?
So this question is, how can we use faith as a coping mechanism, so a private coping mechanism in our lives, a resource?
Are these people believers that you're talking about, or non-believers, or
mix
or both?
Yeah.
Okay, then that's. Yeah.
I was waiting for you to.
I forgot to turn my beeper on. Usually, that's how you can get out of the room when you're not sure how to answer something. do you want me to go?
I don't. As framed, I'm not sure I have an answer. I mean, I think it'd be interesting to. And there certainly is a research literature that suggests a lot of objective consequences of being a religious a person of faith, practitioner, that starting to, you know, being faithful in church and prayer and so on is increases health benefits as much as stopping smoking or other sorts of things. I'm not sure how far that's going to take you, but...
Yeah, for example, you know, people who belong to congregations of faith tend to be healthier, and that's probably because of social support effects. But I actually, you know, you hear a lot of people maybe saying to a friend, you know, well, God works everything together for good, you know, and they sort of forget that that's a conditional statement in the Bible for those who love Him and are called according to His purposes. And so I think... sometimes the coping strategies that we might use as people of faith would not necessarily be relevant for people who aren't people of faith because either the strategies that we're suggesting aren't, you know, something that they would want to engage in, or, you know, well, maybe if you stopped sleeping around, you know, you might feel better about yourself. Well, these kinds of lifestyle choices are not really understandable outside of a loving relationship with Jesus. And so part of me wants to just say they need to meet Jesus, and they need to meet Jesus through you. And at the same time, I want to say, you know, talking about your own way of using religious coping, you know, talking about what prayer means to you, and talking about prayer as conversation with someone you love, as listening as well as talking, why you pray, how you pray, how your own living life in its joys and in its sorrows is related to your relationship with God, is what I would say people need to hear from us. They need to hear genuine thinking people sharing what we do, and let them ask questions, you know, sort of put something out there about how you live your life in that way, and see if they take the bait and want to ask more.
I'm Susan Cross, and I'm a social psychologist. And I heard a little, maybe just a touch of disagreement between the two of you, in that Dr. Canning talks about the applied consequences of what we do, that we see their relevance. I'm transposing what you said, but then Dr. Priest talks about the fact that we Christians need to be in the full range of the research areas that our discipline is engaged in. So I'm wondering what you say to the student who comes to you and says, boy, I really love cognitive psychology, but the part of it not sure how that's going to help people. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should be a counselor instead. Mm-hmm. What do you say to them? Or an anthropological, I mean, there's a corollary in anthropology. I really love this thing, but I don't see how it applies to missions or to...
Okay, let's take missions for just a minute. In one of the things that happened back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, a lot of churches created a discourse about vocation where being a missionary was a sacred vocation. Studying literature, doing science was not. And part of what's interesting that happened is you had missionaries traveling around the world, and then you had lots of closed doors all around the world, and you had people from all over the world coming back to the United States to study and going to the most secular place and the place where there was least Christian presence. That is, they're coming to the university, and the professors are the ones that they're looking to with deep respect and so on. So that even if what you're thinking of is a Christian witness to the larger, diverse world, there are consequences on not having social presence in those key positions. I would also argue that there's all kinds, you know, that having Christians at the cutting edge of knowledge in these areas, I don't know if this quite falls under cognitive psychology, but there's memory is one area that there's fascinating research on memory, and it's enormously consequential. So there are, including in mission settings, there are a high number of counselors and others working with MKs and others and helping them recover memories of abuse that were not consciously present a little bit earlier. And so the status of those memories, what in the world are we dealing with here when someone in their 40s working with Dan Allender's workbook that's coaching them and how to imagine what must have happened to them and read body symptoms and memories and so on. What I've found interesting as I've gotten into this is I can't find Christians on the cutting edge of research related to those sorts of things. They're all positioned in I'm overstating. Many of the ones that I've been talking with tend to be positioned in applied ways, which means they don't know. They can't assess at the top, most sophisticated levels how to think through these issues. We desperately need Christians positioned at the cutting edge of science in each of these areas, not only in kind of doctoral level education and research and so on, but there are consequences. Mm-hmm. Both in terms of simply a Christian presence with a witness, and in terms of all kinds of practical payoffs, potentially, if in fact these memories aren't real, truthful memories, but in fact they're being constructed, and there's some evidence that sometimes this is happening, of damaged lives and all reputations and so on. The kinds of knowledge claims that are being worked through are enormously consequential. So I would say I didn't hear us as disagreeing with each other. I didn't hear anything that you said that I was like, no, I disagree with that. I think we need people in all of these sorts of areas.
Yeah, children's memory is a great example to use of the importance of basic science kinds of questions being asked and studied, and then that's an example that has obvious applied applications later. Not all basic science does, nor should it, you know, it can be valuable in and of itself. And I certainly am a believer in the importance of theory-oriented scholarship. I think along with Walter Storff, my own situation as a American white woman educated is sort of not being able to go back from seeing the injustices in the world, and then in my own discipline, the striking lack of attention to really precious portions of our community, really, is an alarm bell that I think has to be sounded. It's a prophetic message that I think that the church needs, that the psychological community needs, and I've have been caught up in that because God showed me that, not because of anything about my own upbringing or who I am. And so my desire to think of the justice implications in healthcare, and in mental health care in particular, and what it means for us as scholars and practitioners is something that I feel is central, and it's a central question for all believers, and it doesn't negate the importance of the totality of what knowledge is and how it can be approached. But I think everybody ought to ask themselves, what has justice got to do with it, what I'm doing?
I guess I just want to push that point a little further, because it does seem to me that you again return to the sort of utilitarian angle, if you want to call it that,
okay,
or a consequentialist idea. We're going to do research because of somehow finding a way to how it impacts the quote unquote real world. And
yeah.
I started with that because I'm a game theorist and mathematical economist, right?
Okay.
And,
awesome.
People ask me, what do you do? I say, well, I do mathematical economics and theory. And they say, well, how does that impact the real world? Or something to that effect, when I'm in church or something like that. I guess I feel that there's too much of an emphasis on sort of taking that utilitarian approach to our motivation and scholarship. And you said, Dr. Priest, it seems to me that there's a real lack of Christians in across the cutting edge of research, which I don't know if you can comment on that. It just seems like our knee-jerk reaction is to go in that more utilitarian direction.
I'll just say real briefly, I really didn't talk enough about the whole notion of covenant, and the notion of covenant and the love aspect, the voluntary love aspect of covenant, is really a sort of beauty and worship notion where we engage in a relationship with God because of his own intrinsic worth. And we sort of fall in awe before him, and we worship him. And worship is not a utilitarian activity in my read of what it is. It's intrinsically useless, except insofar as the one who's worshipped derives, you know, anything from it. And so I think that's incredibly important. And my own journey, I was a music major, and I sang opera, and I used to have conversation after conversation with my professors about, will this benefit anyone? And I continue to wrestle with your excellent concern. And I do think in my discipline, there's probably an overemphasis on applied kinds of concerns. But I'm anxious to let you respond.
I think sometimes there's certain Christian subcommunities that the only way to justify your involvement is with this kind of an applied sort of a thing. And that's where I feel like sometimes it becomes unhealthy, because it then is directing people into social work, not sociology, into, you know, it's kind of, well, unless I can immediately show in my own field of anthropology, a lot of the early Christian anthropologists went into anthropology by means of missions. So they were missionaries, then they became anthropologists. And quite a few of them weren't that committed to anthropology. It was just on the route to this other thing. So you got a pretty big block of people. They may have got, several of them I interviewed, got PhDs at Michigan, working with a group in New Guinea or whatever, and did great work, but they just, and then in their 70s, it's like, wow, you know, Michigan wanted to publish my dissertation, but I just never had time for it. Now I'd like to do it, but I'm having memory episodes. And in some ways, if you have too many of those sorts of people, it really creates a negative view of Christians in anthropology. We need Christians who are discovering Maya Blue stuff. We need Christians who are not looking like they're involved for purely, narrowly instrumental reasons, but who are there covering the full field in the same way that others are. But, you know, my bias is still a little bit to constantly saying, and what are the payoffs? Not just practically, but intellectually and in terms of, but I do think there are dangers of some Christian communities fostering an attitude that says, unless I'm doing social work in studying sociology, then it's not a value. I mean, it's a PhD in sociology, PhD in anthropology. Why would a Christian want to do that?
It can actually indicate a kind of driven need to see results in a way that's not really coming from God. It's a self-focused need to see that you've helped someone, which may not be the kind of calling that you're really describing, and it may not even be realistic. It might not be what it's actually like to be a helper.
in public health, I think that there is the NIH related as redirected resources and identified dissemination and translation is a huge issue out of years and years of research that hasn't really affected communities. And so I think that we ought to still value the application of our research.
That's a good point. We have problems at both ends, don't we? Yeah, absolutely.
Laurel Harper, graduate student in political science. I was wondering, so in my experience, at least so far within graduate school, I found it, I guess, both easier and more practical to just kind of keep my faith life and my academic life separate in terms of not bringing the, either faith-based issues or whatever into my scholarship. And so I'm just kind of wondering from both your perspectives, whether you think that we can flourish if we do keep those things separate.
It's a hard audience. I'm ready to
I personally think in the long run, if you're thinking over the course of your whole professional involvement, so it's not just your doctoral program, etc., that if you're not, it may be that what looks like in public that you're not bringing Christian things in can still be bringing them in. That is, my doctoral dissertation looked at rituals of purification. I was critiquing some common theories in the discipline, rituals of purification. Things that were impacting me were Christian. I was trying to think through, if that view is right, then what does that do to my understanding of rituals of purification in the Old Testament? So I was doing any number of intellectual moves that didn't show up as part of my explicit argument and appeal and use of evidence. So I think some sorts of things that we do, we may do. We may have a very careful assessment in this setting of what needs to be said, what I need to get into. But to the extent that you're engaging issues that Scripture itself at some level addresses or has bearing on, it does seem to me in the long run that you're going to be better off flourishing as a Christian in that area if you can figure out some ways to build bridges and links. But I personally wouldn't think you need to feel guilty if you're not somehow declaring yourself in your writings to be a Christian or picking a subject that kind of brings this to the fore.
How do you mean keep it separately, if you don't mind me asking?
It's not something that I actually talk about with my faculty or anything like that, but even within my research, either the topics that I study or the kind of questions that I ask are in no way related to religion. And I don't foresee them going in that direction either.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you're did you say you're in political science?
Uh-huh. I studied commerce.
And what led you to political science?
Good question. I used to think I wanted to go to law school, and then I realized I liked studying and going through that whole process more than I liked the idea of actually participating in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the confrontational side of things that I like the analytical of understanding what to other people is just something that they either disregard or are very passionate about but argue about.
Mm-hmm. Because, I think that you've asked such an important and such a large question that I feel that anything that I would say would be almost disrespectful without hearing more about your story. I mean, it's a mental illness if we act in the world and the self that we think of as the self can't be aware of that. So the notion of somehow being a person of faith, being a Christian, and completely divorcing that, cutting that off from what we do, you know, in our vocational lives is certainly not an example of health or flourishing. But I'm guessing that that's not what you're talking about. It's the hugely complex question of how do you live, you know, what do you do in your relationships with your professors? So you don't talk about it all the time, you know. I still recall I had a famous social psychologist for my social psychology class, and we were talking about all kinds of discrimination, and I said, you know, I feel like the one group that you can't say in here, and it's like in my last year of panel, I said, I kind of feel like the last thing I could say would be that, like, I'm a born-again Christian, and I think such and such. Total dead silence. You know, every other imaginable life choice would often, you know, people would lean forward and chat, you know, talk and discuss, and dead silence. And, you know, do you do that every second? Is it important for everybody to know that, you know, probably not. As you get to know people, as you have relationships with people, is your identity as a believer at play? Ought it to be? Yeah, I bet it is. And I bet living out your calling, if you're finding yourself in political science because it's part of who God made you to be, I think that goes back to the question over here of, you know, if you're made to be a mathematician, it reminds me of the Chariots of Fire statement, Eric Little, when he said, when I run, I feel God's pleasure. Is that what he says? When I run, I feel, there's something amazingly powerful about that statement. That was a statement of worship. That was a statement of self-recognition of who the Creator made him to be. And exercising his gifts and calling in that. So you are, if you're doing that.
My son last week told me, Dad, when I play video games, I feel God's
But not when I clean up my room. Yeah, you can work that too.
I'm not sure if you were getting at this, but I don't think what we're saying is that the subject of religion has to be a part of what you're doing. That is, you can study the political and not make at all the subject of religion and the political process central to what you do. But of course, still, as a Christian, you have to be asking if I'm dealing with issues of power, if I'm dealing with issues of justice, and so on. At some level, I have to be nurturing understandings that somehow connect with Christian faith, whether it's part of the public domain of what I talk about in this setting or not, so that at some level you're being consistent and grappling with.
I just want to... Well, because I'm a faculty in political science, so I just want to speak about our question. Yeah. So I'm a professor in political science. I had the same situation as her as a graduate student before I graduated. So I separated my work from my, you know, Christian life. But somehow I think I didn't intend to. Actually, like when I wrote my dissertation, I didn't choose a topic, you know, because I'm a Christian. But I end up writing about the impact of globalization on income inequality and poverty. But the view that I had was totally different from, you know, popular view that economists have right now. So I didn't intend to actually, you know, write it because I'm a Christian, but I think I had different view from other, you know, political scientists or economists. So I was, you know, because right now there are really the neoliberal, you know, economist view is really popular right now. That, you know, if you have economic growth, then it's done. You know, it doesn't matter that the gap between the rich and the poor increase, or you know, the poverty increase. As long as your national wealth increase, you know, it doesn't matter. But my view was different in my dissertation I wrote about it, and you know, I didn't intend to, but I think, you know, somehow indirectly, my personal faith or my Christian view actually, you know, revealed in my dissertation. So I think even if she's interested in Congress, somehow, you know, Washa, she's, you know, writing or working her dissertation or, you know, study on a certain topic, I think it would be revealed into her work. But so, I mean, while I was listening to your talks or speeches, and I thought that it's really extremely hard for me to actually directly talk about religion or Christianity in my work. But I think, you know, I think a priest, actually, focus priest, actually talked about it. And by just positioning yourself in that position, by being a professor in the field in political science, there are not so many political scientists who are Christian or, you know, came out as a Christian and revealing that they are Christian. I was at UCLA and I was looking for a Christian faculty member. I know they are there, but they didn't really reveal themselves. We tried to have some Christian meetings in graduate, like in my department, but no faculty members joined us. So like, you know, because now I'm a faculty and I had a student coming in, came in and said, I heard that you're a Christian faculty. How did you know that?
Do you have tenure yet?
Hours, so I had to listen to him. I shouldn't. But so I think by you know, just being there as a Christian faculty member, there are lots of things to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We are salt, and you have to be in something to be useful. And it's possible for salt to lose its flavor, right?
We're not about to have a question over here.
Two things that something both you said. You speaking about the knowledge of humans and how that's a very necessary prerequisite to serving an anthropological perspective. And then you talking about the literature search on underserved populations when you're looking at Christian journals and then seeing that it hasn't really changed in 10 years. And from the perspective of Teach for America, I was very excited about my job because it's a combination of solving educational inequity and my faith, which is Christianity. One of the challenges we've run into is how do we push Christians to know about and care about underserved communities? And to be honest, it's been something that I've been really surprised by. And at first I thought, well, Teach for America is a secular organization, so maybe that's why. But then I talked to someone who runs Denver Street Schools, which is a Christian school in low-income communities, and he says most of their funders are secular communities. Most of the people who care are not Christian people.
That's right.
So, and then I guess kind of the other piece of it is when we do give people care, they are focused 100% on salvation. And are frequently shocked when we tell them a lot of the students actually are Christian. Like they know about their salvation. Yeah. They don't know how to read. They don't know how to... So how do we kind of transform the mindset? And I think in academia, it hopefully kind of spread out into the rest of the country.
Well, I think it's... What I was going to say is a perfect example of what you were talking about. Emerson and Smith, have you read Emerson and Smith's work, Divided by Faith? I think that should be required reading for every American. Sociologists describing the gap in attitudes in America between, the biggest gap in attitudes about race in America between blacks and whites of faith. And I have my students read that every year, and they delineate these cultural tools, sociocultural tools that white evangelicals in America use, that we see things individualistically and we're sort of anti-structuralist, we can't see structural racism, we're isolated from one another, and they delineate the cultural tools that really describe what I think is one of the largest barriers in getting people. We're so disconnected from one another, and the most important thing I think I do as an instructor is I get people into those communities, meeting people, and then they start to care.
Part of what Brian Howell and I are both trying to do with this thing of you have Christian youth groups. When I was a youth pastor in 82, we would go to Fun in the Sop, so it was a beach retreat event. Powerful speakers talking about sacrifice and, you know, not buying into American hedonism and so on. I mean, we're spending our time on the beach playing volleyball, and ethnic minorities minister to us, and we had speakers talking about racial justice and injustice, but it's a bunch of white kids from the suburbs. Now, most youth, at least for many youth groups, probably a pretty high proportion of youth groups have an annual event which is no longer a retreat to the beach or to a camp or to whatever, it's an annual mission trip. So now you're still talking about service, but you're actually, you know, how important what your service is, I don't know, but you're doing service. You're talking about wealth and poverty, but you're not at a retreat center or in the suburbs, you're seeing poverty in Tijuana or inner city Chicago, whatever. But part of what Brian and I, as we've been researching this, feel like is most of the leaders of this tend to spiritualize what they see in the world. They spiritualize the poverty, they spiritualize, you know, you kind of, in our church we have children's sermons where I get a little frustrated with kind of the free association that the kids are being taught about how to engage the world, just anything reminds me of Jesus. And I think you've got almost the same thing going on. Some of these, you know, you're constructing your own spiritual experience in this short-term trip. And part of the research we've been looking at is to what extent. So here you've got probably over 1 million people every year going to somewhere in Latin American world on a short-term mission trip. I mean, and then they come back, and their neighbors are from Latin America too. Here, there's more Latinos in the U.S. than Canadians in Canada, right? I mean, that's how many, 43 million. So you're going over there, and you can go to Peru and serve with the poor. You come back, it's maybe a 10-day block of time. You can now apply to Wheaton or Harvard or whatever and do global volunteering. But are you like some tourists, at least the anthropology of tourism suggests, some tourists flee social others at home and then exoticize abroad, go abroad and have empathetic interests, but you're glad, you're not wanting relations that complicate your life permanently. You want to go do something, come back, apply. So it's possible to have a complete disconnect. So part of what Brian and I have both been working on, and several other scholars, is can we, through research, actually move ourselves into the center of discussion on the part of all the people who are leading short-term mission groups? There's a huge amount of energy. It is intercultural. It is inter-ethnic, etc. There's a structure already in place. These youth pastors need to do it. It's part of their job description. If I tell them as a seminary student, stop, they say, well, I don't have a job if I don't do it. So rather than saying stop, can we say, are there ways to produce through research and writing high-quality materials that are saying, here's what you need to think about. Mm-hmm. Here's how you need to frame the experience. Here's how this experience can teach people to change their college majors, to raise profound intellectual questions about why is there wealth and poverty in the world in the way that we see it. So I think there's ways that research can come together where we say, how do we capture, how do we strategically get a voice in the places that matter?
Can I just add something to this real fast? In terms of one of the things that we talked a lot about research, but the fact is a lot of us are going to spend our time teaching as well. Mm-hmm. And how you teach and what you teach about is hugely important in how you communicate these issues. Mm-hmm. And this is one area where I think no matter what discipline you're in, you can think about how the examples you use, how the readings you use, yeah, how the way that you interact with your students, the kinds of things you do to educate yourself about issues of diversity, of issues of race, issues of justice. These are hugely important issues, and you can take time or you know, resources at a university or wherever you are to make sure that you can bring that stuff into your classroom. It's not enough, like you were saying, Kevin, about it. It's not enough to just be tolerant. Like, oh, I'm just going to make sure that I don't make the mistake of calling on the black kid to represent all the black people, or assuming that the Chinese kid doesn't speak English or whatever. It's not enough to not do that. You have to know something about how to interact with your classroom, and then bring things into your curriculum that are very self-consciously pushing things of justice and concern for the world. And this can happen in a secular or a Christian classroom. So I think all of us, and some of us are going to be in institutions where the research is not going to be the main thing that we do, where you're going to be teaching four loads or something like that. But you're going to have hundreds of students coming to your classroom. So thinking about how you can ensure that issues of justice and concern and the things that are close to God's heart are being in your curriculum, I think, are really important.
I was going to say that another way that to talk to people who are actually doing that, who have contacts with people in the academy and partners with professors, so that they actually work with congregations and they galvanize people who would prefer this charity and service delivery into trying to push them to system change kind of thinking, which is really hard to do, but people like Bread for the World, that's what they specialize in doing, and they have training actually for the Christian public, for certain age groups to teach how to do that. Youth ministries for peace and justice have a list that they've added to Bread for the World, but it's actually what they do. So they have regional coordinators, which is that's their job, is go out to churches and try to figure out what way they can talk to this particular church about the work they could be doing next door, instead of maybe going to Guatemala.
Do you want to add anything to that, or should we go to another question?
That's great.
Other question?
I can add one more thing, actually, in response to that question. A place to start, since I know Teach for America, you're recruiting mainly recent college graduates, would be, secular colleges and universities. Some of the campus ministries, like InterVarsity, do emphasize themes like justice and equality, and they offer experiences like summer urban projects for students. So the students who go through those experiences would be naturally already aware and inclined, to do something like Teach for America. And then at Christian colleges, I'm sure at places like me, I worked at Azusa Pacific University in California. They actually had an urban semester, they called the Los Angeles Term Project, where students actually spent the whole semester in urban LA and spent it with host families who lived in the neighborhood, worked with community organizations, and took classes at the same time. So they were getting the sociological and anthropological training, and then also, being engaged in discussions about how that related to their faith. So those are natural places where people are already being prepared to have their eyes open to some of those questions. I actually had a question as well. going back to kind of the disciplinary discussion that what you kind of addressed at the beginning of your talk, one thing I struggled with during the first few years of my PhD program was really feeling the pull between these two communities of support that you talked about. So, as you know, in academics, particularly in getting to a PhD program and then become a faculty member, you have your professional associations, which are trying to pull you in and get you more involved, do presentations, posters, chair a session, volunteer on the various committees, that sort of thing. But then I felt like, I felt pulled. Part of me wanted to get involved more in the disciplinary community, but then part of me also knew that I needed the support of fellow believers, especially those who were trying to integrate faith with their learning. But generally the communities of believers I found weren't necessarily people in my discipline or doing, in my kind of subfield within my discipline. So those communities were very much separate, and being a PhD student and feeling overwhelmed already, and also working part-time, I felt like with my limited time, it was really hard to figure out where should I really invest myself. And I'm just wondering what advice you would give to graduate students in trying to make those choices.
I mean, it's hard. We're finite, and we really can't do everything. And I think different people are going to have different decisions that you're going to have to make. I have some friends, let's say Korean Christians, who sometimes their church has such obligations on them and the round of activities that it's not necessarily helping them with integration professionally. It's just filling their life with a competing set of obligations that makes it hard to really be successful in this other area. Most fields you'll have in anthropology, which is probably a field that, by comparison with some of your fields, does not have a lot of Christians, but there's probably at least a couple hundred out there. Every year at the American Anthropology Association, there is a gathering. It's on the program. The Network of Christian Anthropologists, Brian Howell, chairs that. So it becomes a networking thing. We go out to eat afterward, and people just find it very helpful to connect with other. There's fishnets. There's a listserv for Christian anthropologists. Not high volume amount, but it creates, again, an online community. We don't have what you have, which is journals mm-hmm. that are explicitly Christian. You're going to each face your own situation. I just would argue that it's helpful to push to really nurture the intellectual Christian side of your life. I think InterVarsity does a good job of this, and so hopefully that's doing it for some of you. So that you're doing some readings that are not assigned readings. You're doing some of your readings that are a little different set of readings than what your non-Christian classmates might do. Now, whether that's 5% of your readings or 30%, you know, I don't know, but it seems to me that at least some of the nurturing of that intellectual side is core to being able eventually to feel like it's really come together in a wholesome, healthy way. What it will look like for someone teaching at a secular university who's not focused on religion, who's focused on political science in arenas that aren't focused on religion, it's going to look very different. I teach in a seminary. I mean, that's a very different setting from but at some level, I think all of us need to just at least be struggling with trying to pull some of that in.
Before, so, I just need to mention, for sociologists, there is an organization called ACTS, Association of Christians Teaching Sociology, and you can do a Google search for it, Association of Christians Teaching Sociology, so if you're a sociologist or sociology major, you want to find some Christian sociologists. They meet once a year, usually at a Christian college somewhere. So that's another resource. Sally, you want to add something?
Just, you know, I think it's important to think developmentally about, and maybe that's the wrong word, but sort of what are the important purposes in your life right now? I think, and having both a professionally discerning and a spiritually discerning eye to that, because if you're moving, if you're in the beginning of your career, or you're moving toward tenure, or for me, someday I would like to be a full professor, and one of the things I really have not spent a lot of time on is networking. I haven't been on committees in professional societies. That's one thing that I've consciously chosen not to do. My husband and I have something we call the rocking chair test. And when we're trying to make decisions, we say, you know, hopefully when we're on the rocking chairs together in our old age, if we still remember who the other person is and ourselves, and we say, hey, remember back when so-and-so and so-and-so, are we going to regret that we didn't, you know, am I going to regret that I wasn't on that committee? Or am I, you know, I'm really moved by your study of these, you know, people at the end point of their careers and thinking about legacy. And it's been really important for me to ask, what am I going to regret? And for me, trying to be clear about the importance of the relationships that I have. But I don't think there's any way to go through these kind of callings without loss and without grief. And there are parts of my vision of who I would be by now, things I would have done by now, the size of things I've done that just are not there, and I'm not sure they're ever going to be there. And that's a loss, that's a very real loss. And at the same time, I can honestly say I don't regret in any large way any of the sort of major life choices that I've made so far. And so part of it is I just think we get so many messages that you can somehow figure out, maybe it's that balance thing again, we can somehow figure out how to do it all. And number one, it's a developmental dynamic process where we have different things that need to be emphasized at different times of our lives, whether that's in our personal or professional life. And then also I just think there's loss. Probably there's some people in the room here who are going to be able to do it all, but I'm not one of them.
We've talked a lot about being a Christian in the academy, doing good work and those types of things. And especially Dr. Priest, as you were talking about the two communities that we kind of have to operate in to live integrated lives, I'm wondering about the other direction. So I'm sure many of the graduate students here have had experiences of oh, what do you do? Well, I'm a grad student. Oh, what are you studying? Biomedical engineering. Nobody here is doing that. And the eyes glaze over. I'm an anthropologist. Huh. My kid plays t-ball. You know, these types of things. So I'm wondering how you deal with those kind of dynamics in your church life, because, I mean, we have to have those good networks in order to be integrated. On the one hand, how do you deal with the eyes blazing over? And on the other hand, how do you deal with being an expert in a social structure of the church in which the experts everybody already respects, like the pastors and the missionaries, are living and teaching things you think are directly and horribly opposed to the things that you think are true.
This is my favorite question so far, because before I was married, I was in graduate school, and going to parties as a clinical psychology student, when men would ask me what I was studying, who are the psychologists? Okay, when somebody, what do you do? And you say, what are you studying? Psychology. What do they say?
Are you analyzing me?
Are you analyzing me, or are you reading my mind right now? And this was my fantasy. I never did it. I wanted to say, yeah, and I'm not picking anything up. Ways of, yeah, I'm in the such and such grad school. What are you studying? People. So anyway, go ahead, say important things. I just had to say that. I love that. So basically hide who you are. It's like
So the first question is,
I'm sorry.
Eyes glazing over, and then how do you handle being?
I mean, part of vocation is the recognition that I stand before God, and that there's a lot of Christians who will not appreciate what you're doing. I mean, even in a church where a small church, when I was in doctoral, where I thought I had explained why this was good, what I'm doing. I'm a cultural anthropologist, right? I get back from our 2 years in Peru, and people, how was the dig? And part of it is just say, look, I've got to be inner-directed in the sense that that there's going to be a lot of people that don't appreciate and understand and get it, but I have to be very intentional about finding a sub-community of people. It's going to be a small sub-community who can appreciate, who can understand, who I can have in different places conversations with. Some of my interlocutors, it's only through reading. I read what they write, and we've never met, but I'm feeding myself on the thoughts of another Christian who's engaged some of the same. It can be lonely, I think, for a lot of people.
Yes.
I mean, where there's, I had at least the spouse with me the whole time who was very engaged, did her own MA in anthropology, and then PhD in sociology.
She found the light.
That's how she would see it.
Can I just add something real quick to that? That in my experience, you can tell me if this is different from how you've seen it, is that the status of grad students in the United States is not a high status one. You know, sort of like, oh, so you're just, leeching on society and doing nothing, But once you become a faculty person, or once you have professions, I was one. Once, especially if you do become a faculty member in college, then you're actually very high status. And you probably will have a position in your church where people will look at you quite differently when you say, I teach at such and such university, or I teach at such and such college. And there are some people in my church who are very comfortable, a couple of other faculty members who are very comfortable, or seem to be very comfortable, with people calling them Dr. So-and-so. And I rather don't do that, because I think that there is a potential to abuse the kind of position that you have when, let him talk, because he's the doctor. with those who have much power comes much responsibility. I think you can take the things that are part of that and use them well, but it's just encouragement to those of you who find yourself in sort of grad student limbo and feel like, the church just totally has no place for me. You will have a place when you're done with your graduate degree. You will find that there is more opportunity for you to have a voice in your congregations. And I would just encourage you to be involved
in your congregations in ways that are really constructive and very helpful, but are not, you know, lording it over people and are just engaged with what's going on.
Ma'am?
Yes. When I was in grad school, I noticed that some of my fellow students were not necessarily interested in Christianity, but they knew that I was Christian, mm-hmm. and so they had certain expectations about how I would behave. For instance, if they had something bad going on in their lives, they'd come to me because they think she's a Christian, she's going to listen to me. I was wondering if, what kind of expectations people have of you as Christian academics or a Christian in your office.
Well, heck, I'm a psychologist, so you can imagine. It can be overwhelming. We have amazing students at Wheaton, and they're coming to become psychologists themselves, and they're working through, they're not just studying concrete structures, like that was a class that my husband had in his engineering master's. You know, they're studying things that are deeply touching them, as you said, in your discipline as well. And we have a lot of mentoring that happens in our context. And at the same time, I think it's important to find the boundaries. As an instructor, I'm always going to have an evaluative role. And it's very important for me to make sure that my students understand that I'm not their therapist, number one, because that's a non-evaluative role. And it has a level of confidentiality that an instructor doesn't have because I'm working on a team with people. And what they tell me is not necessarily going to stay between me and them, although there's many reasons that, many situations where it can. So first of all, I think I have to work hard, we all do in our program, to help sort of help everyone understand what our role is. Because we do want to be mentors, we do want to be supportive, and we are really shaping the character as well as the mind of the students in our program. And so I think it's a wonderful, I think Christians can be some of the most holistic people on the planet. We can engage the whole person, and I think that's part of what we do. And if you're being naturally sought out like that, it's because God made you in such a way that you can be available, and you're probably showing love and respect for them in ways that they don't see in the world, and that's a beautiful thing. And at the same time, it's important to understand where our responsibilities can end and what we're not capable of doing with people as well, and making sure that they understand that so that they're not hurt by expecting something from us that we can't give them.
Not to add to that, but just to his second question, one brief comment where you're talking about engaging the Christian community versus kind of the broader. It's a tough challenge, I think, for many of us, where when you write or you publish, you have to decide who's your audience. And when Stan Jones at Wheaton does a major research project on homosexuality and Christians who were struggling with homosexuality, when he publishes within a varsity, it's a choice, and it may have different consequences from if we published in another place. I've lived my whole life struggling with this because I'm more located within the Christian community. So I tried to do this one publication with Oxford University Press, and I did current anthropology, but then I'm switching to very explicitly Christian settings where that doesn't count in my anthropology side. I can't use that, and if I were in certain settings, it would be very problematic as far as actually moving me toward tenure and promotions and so on. So everyone here faces a different mix, and some of you are going to have a calling where part of what you do is write for Christian audiences, Christian publications. And some of you, at least for a major part of your life, you can't afford to spend time going in quite that direction. We're all differently located socially, and I think it's going to look different.
I'm going to use my prerogative as the track leader to take the last few minutes try to sum up a little bit. I think part of what's been said is that y'all in the social sciences are an incredibly important part of the body of Christ. Mm-hmm.
there's no claim that we're the most important part. I mean, I think I am sometimes. But we are important, and we're a neglected part of the body of Christ in many ways. We're important to the body of Christ. We have to watch pride at times about this. But we ought to know that we do have a role to play. And the role is multiple. It is to be a prophetic voice to the church. It's to be a prophetic voice to the unchurched as well. You know, we're to be critical thinking in many different ways. It's to help support people in the church. There's a lot of ways in which we are very important. I think Dr. Priest really articulated the need for to be more individuals, Christians who go into social sciences. I thought that there's many Christians, you know, they're called to ministry. God bless them. I know I can do it. You know, that's great. I think some called to ministry really should be going to academia. And part of what will happen, hopefully, as more and more of us go into social sciences, will be a model to help influence more to go into there to play some of this role. And so I just want to really emphasize that part of, I think, what comes out is a certain insecurity that we have. You know, I only do sociology, I only do anthropology. You know, I'm not, you know, we're not engineers or biology or in these great battles or even theology. We are still incredibly important. God's going to be using us in different ways. And so part of what I hope comes out of this is that we'll find different ways. You'll find the way God's going to use you. All right. Well, I think it's about almost time for dinner. Are you all going to be around for dinner?
I think so.
Yeah, so if you have more questions, take them to the dinner, you know.